Hello, everybody, and welcome, libertarians, conservatives, anarchists, and old guys with a cannon in their front yard. This is Jonesing for Liberty, and I'm your host, Rod Jones. Joining me today is Vince Gordon of the Student Post, a colleague of mine, as I also write for the Student Post. I think we're going to have some very insightful and interesting discussions today. Don't forget, we are a project of Bipartisan Media. You can go to our main website at bipartisanmedia.com. That's bipartisanmedia.com. Please go there, check it out. Lots of great stuff there. Lots of great information. We have a swag shop, information on all the podcasts, a schedule that is outdated but will be updated shortly. All kinds of great stuff there, so please go check that out. And bipartisanmedia.com. Thank you. All right, so Vince, hello. How are you doing?
Doing great. Thank you for having me on, Rod. I appreciate it.
All right. So real quick, before we get into our segments, why don't you tell us and the audience a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Yeah. So I am very into politics. I am, like you introduced me, I am a contributor for the Student Post, and I just started writing for them, and I'm very excited about that. I like to get my voice out there. I would consider myself a conservative, and so I like to give that point of view out there, but also I'm very respectful of other people's views and love to learn from, you know, other people on both sides of the parties, and also, you know, the whole libertarian aspect of things, which I have come to adopt in a certain way after taking a political spectrum test. But yeah, I'm just very into politics, love following it, and I love talking about it.
All right, sounds good. I'm looking forward to discussing the news with you. So before we get into our first segment, which is basically just the current events, we talk about what's been going on in the world. Before we do that, just a reminder, we love here, I love, as the host of this show, of Jonesing for Liberty, to really analyze the stories that not everyone is looking at. Because there are so many interesting stories out there that aren't covered in the main aspects of the media, whether it's conservative or leftist, because really it's just, it isn't deemed as important to them, but I like to look at that. So first, we're going to look at how Chicago is succumbing to socialism. Excuse me. And there's the Chicago City Council has elected multiple socialists, members of the Democratic Socialist Party, to their city council. So that's pretty interesting. According to CBS Channel 2 in Chicago, a total of 5 Democratic Socialists and possibly a 6th won races for aldermen either in February or in Tuesday's runoff elections. The 6th candidate, Rosanna Rodriguez Sanchez, is trailing longtime Deb Mel by only a few dozen votes. Mel, whose family has represented the 33rd Ward for more than 40 years, is hoping that mail ballots will help maintain her seat. So basically, what we have here is quite simply a takeover, almost, of the Chicago City Council. So that's a pretty interesting development, in my opinion. Vince, what do you think about this?
Absolutely. You know, I completely agree with you. It is very interesting to see that this is happening. What I have to say about that is I think that the reason why the Democratic Socialist Party is just, you know, kind of getting, you know, gaining popularity and traction these days is basically just because, as you see with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, there's a lot of light shining on this party. Also with, you know, you have Bernie Sanders, who is a strong leader of this group. I think that more and more people are buying into what they are selling, which is Medicare for all, free college, a lot of things that sound nice, but economically don't work and are not sound. So I think it's very easy for them to kind of get votes and to get into these positions. And it's kind of a shame of how easy it is to get into these positions, it seems like, by offering illogical fallacies. So honestly, it's very surprising, but I'm very glad that we're covering this because, like you said, it's not being covered by mainstream media, and it definitely should be, especially local elections of all kinds.
Yeah. And again, it's an interesting development, but I wouldn't say an altogether surprising one. I mean, let's face it, Chicago has been a Democratic Party stronghold for quite some time now. I don't think they've elected a Republican governor in at least 30 years, if not more. So that's, you know, again, not unexpected, but still interesting because it's weird to see how this party is gaining so much traction in America. And by a lot of traction, we don't mean actual popularity, because obviously this party is actually smaller than the Libertarian Party by a lot, and is smaller than the Green Party too, I believe, which is very small. But the point being is that it's the vocal minority, you know, it's the people who have really strong beliefs about something, and therefore they're certainly vocal about it, even though the vast majority of people disagree with them. So moving on
Absolutely.
To our next story. According to the Wall Street Journal, lawmakers look to even playing field between news media and tech titans, and they're looking at a measure that would allow news publishers to negotiate together with platform giants to be and this measure might be introduced Wednesday, which actually was Wednesday, so. But
2 days ago.
Yeah, 2 days ago. So there hasn't been an update on that, but it would be interesting if this gets anywhere, because it's basically what it's doing is it's changing an antitrust law, and it would allow newspapers to collaborate into larger organizations in order to stay competitive against non-traditional print media like they themselves are. So, Vince, what is your take on this?
Well, you know, I understand where the traditional media is coming from. You know, they actually don't want to lose their viewership. But at the same time, you know, I'm a big capitalist, and I always believe in building a better mousetrap. And, you know, the reason why you have so many new media outlets coming out now and gaining so much popularity is because they're offering different opposing viewpoints. Some of them are outright conservative, outright liberal, sometimes in the middle and independent. So I think that they're just gaining a lot of popularity. And in all fairness, I think it should stay the way it is. Because if you're building a better mousetrap and if you're providing a better service for people, then I think that is what overall should be winning. I don't think we need to change the antitrust laws on this one.
Yeah, I agree with you. But it is interesting to see, if you actually look at how this is presented, basically what would it do is it would allow print news to basically work in a union, not necessarily a trust, but the wording is to negotiate in union with each other. So it's sort of like workers unionizing against an employer in order to get higher wages or whatever else they would be unionizing for. This law would allow newspapers to band together in groups and then negotiate with tech companies. So pretty interesting stuff. So next up, we have, how according to Breitbart News, House Democrats want oversight over Fox News' editorial decisions. Democrats in the U.S. House of Representatives are demanding to know why Fox News did not publish a story prior to the 2016 election about an alleged affair years before between porn star Stormy Daniels and Donald Trump. And this, because of that, they are now using that as a justification to demand congressional oversight of Fox News and their editorial decisions, which, in my opinion, sounds suspiciously like the beginning of literal government censorship of media. So that would be
exactly.
A really crazy development. It's not going to get anywhere, obviously, because it would have to pass all of Congress, I assume. But either way, it's kind of scary that people are even considering this and that there isn't automatic, massive backlash from people of all political ideologies, since this would simply set a precedent for the next time Republicans take the majority in the House again to do the same to, say, CNN.
Absolutely. I totally agree with you, and I totally see where you're coming from. It is surprising to see that there aren't too many people reacting to this. I mean, there has been talk about this in the past. I mean, obviously, ever since Trump has got elected, it's all been about the media. And I really do think that, you know, the idea that they should have a say in what they're doing in their editorials, I don't think that that's very, you know, that definitely does not reinforce the First Amendment, in my opinion. Even if you don't like what a certain news outlet is saying, you know, I still don't think that you have the ability to censor what it is that they are providing out there and what they are maybe holding back. Now, unless it has to do with maybe national security, maybe that could be a different thing. But when it comes to something, you know, like reporting the news, I don't think that that should ever be infringed upon.
100%. And I really hope this doesn't get anywhere. Again, I don't think it will, but I really, really hope that this doesn't move anywhere. because, again, it will literally allow the House to approve, it will force Fox News to go through the House of Representatives before they make any quote-unquote major editorial decisions. So that's pretty much that with that story. Now let's look at how major powers are converging on Venezuela. According to a report by, According to a report by The Stranger, they say, quote, that a world-ending storm, end quote, of a third world war is gathering in Venezuela. So obviously this is probably more dramatic than it needs to be, but it is really interesting because if you look at it, right now we have U.S. troops, not a lot, very low amount, U.S. troops in Venezuela. Yeah. At the same time, I believe about a week ago, Russia landed some giant military jets at a civilian airfield in Venezuela, offloaded a few thousand soldiers and some military vehicles and some military advisors, and then they just took off and left again. And now, according to this article, China is actually has landed troops in Venezuela as well, although it is unclear the number. And it's also while Russia has clearly stated that they are siding with Maduro if anything goes south down there, China has not stated who will be siding with any potential war down there. So this is kind of scary to me because it's interesting but scary at the same time, because you have this small little issue down there where finally someone decided to oppose Maduro and of course got exiled, but you know, that would be a relatively small issue. Maybe the U.S. would get involved, but hopefully not. And really, I didn't expect at all Russia or China to get involved with this, but here they are. So, Vince, what's your take on this?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I agree with you. What's going down in Venezuela is absolutely horrible for everybody involved. And, you know, I mean, I don't know if I'm too surprised that Russia is siding with Maduro on this one. But I do have to say that China coming in and putting troops down there is very interesting as well, and it does give people the right to raise some eyebrows and kind of wonder what's going on. And as you said, I don't think we know as of right now who they would side with if anything was to happen. That seems like a pretty big deal to me. Definitely a cause for a little bit of worry down there, and it's for some attention to be focused on. However, the thing is that it's very interesting to me. Russia says that they side with Maduro. However, if you look at some of the members of the Democratic Party, you have them defending Maduro. So it's very interesting that, there's talk about collusion with Russia and everything like that. But in reality, when it comes down to the facts, the parties are really leaning more with Maduro when it comes to the Democratic Party. It seems pretty interesting to me. But yeah, I mean, Venezuela, the whole thing is a giant mess, and there's so much going on down there right now. And there's just a lot going on, especially with the troops coming in and out. I would say there is some need for some worry, but hopefully nothing bad will happen out of that.
Yeah, but also, did you hear, Colombia actually recently revoked, I'm probably going to mispronounce this as I always do, revoked Guaido's asylum rights and has now said that they will no longer protect him. So,
wow, I did not hear that.
That is not going to be fun for him, because obviously Venezuela is now going to try to infiltrate whatever part of Colombia he's residing in and take
him
down. So we might unfortunately see him go after all this time of fighting against Maduro, which would be really sad.
And it would be, absolutely.
Yeah, so things are just going to hell down there. So that's another thing to look at in the future, because really, honestly, people have been saying for the past few years, if World War III is going to happen, it's going to be because China or America makes some move on Taiwan, and then everyone's going to go at war with each other because of that. But now, we actually have such high tension down in Venezuela that might actually start a new world war. Because if anything happens down there where Russian troops are attacking rebels, if there is an uprising against Maduro, and the U.S. is backing the rebels, and one of our troops gets shot by a Russian, or our troop shoots a Russian soldier, then that's going to lead to war. So
exactly. That's a very big problem.
Moving on to our final, one of our final stories for our current events section of today's show. Beto O'Rourke calls for tearing down existing border walls. Now, you may have heard of this, but according to the Washington Times, rising Democratic star Beto O'Rourke of Texas said Thursday that not only does he oppose President Trump's border wall, but he would rip out existing walls along the U.S.-Mexico border. Mr. O'Rourke has been publicly asked by freshman Rep. Dan Crenshaw, Texas Republican, that if border walls are immoral or dangerous, why let the existing ones stand? MSNBC host Chris Hayes repeated the question to him Thursday. His response? Yes, absolutely. I had to take the wall down, said former U.S. Representative from El Paso, Texas, who is widely seen as a possible 2020 presidential hopeful. So that's a quote from the Washington Times, which really shows the increasing extremism, because right now it's really funny, actually, to me. I mean, it's kind of scary at the same time, but I find it really funny how the Democratic primary race has basically turned into a race of who can be more extreme on hot button issues, you know?
And absolutely.
It's crazy, but it's funny because these people believe they have to be more extreme to win. They are pushing each other forward and more and more and more to the left, and not just to the left, but now they're actually going to kind of crazy areas, because you have Bob O'Rourke, I should say, as his real name is. You have Robert O'Rourke suggesting we literally tear down existing border structures, and then you have Julian Castro, who also appears to be running for president, but probably won't get anywhere. He says that he supports 100% open borders, no checkpoints whatsoever. So,
yeah,
again, they're just ridiculous. Pushing each other further and further to the left, and I really don't know what they think they're doing, because they have to have some kind of advisors telling them that the majority of registered Democrats in America aren't that extreme, you know? So what's your thoughts on this?
Oh, 100%. And, you know, there's a couple points, actually, I wanted to talk about in this particular current event. You know, one of them being, like you were just saying, they have to have some type of advisors, right, that are telling them, maybe you shouldn't say that, or maybe you shouldn't go that far. See, the thing is that I think, you know, I say this all the time to some friends of mine when I'm talking politics, and, you know, I hate to say it, but I really do believe that it's true. When you're running as a Democrat these days, you know, especially after this recent election in 2016, I think that it's very easy to win over people. All you have to do is talk about the hot button issues and go to the extremist point that you could possibly go to. And every day there is a new extreme, and it just keeps getting worse and worse and worse. And you see it. It goes further left every single day. Every day you go on Twitter or you open any type of news, I mean, it's already there. There's new things going on all the time. And when I first heard that Beto was saying that he was in favor of taking down the wall, like any of the wall that was already there, any existing parts, I thought that was totally ridiculous for a couple of reasons. You know, first of all, let's say that the wall got built, right? And then he was president after Trump's current term, right? Let's say that there was a wall built, or at least a decent amount, maybe even half. Let's just say that. Let's say that that was happening. He would have to go ahead and then, instead of spending the rest of that money that was, you know, designated to building that wall, he would have to spend that money and maybe more, maybe less, who knows, on taking that wall down by spending more money on that, right? So he'd have to spend money to take the wall down. So I understand that for him, the wall symbolizes, you know, obviously it symbolizes a separation between us and Mexico. But I think the idea here is that he thinks that what that's doing is that it's separating America from Mexico in a moral way. And he thinks that what that's doing is it's saying we don't want anybody coming in here at all. We do not support that at all. But in reality, that's not true. We just want legal immigrants here who are willing to work and who are willing to contribute to America just like everybody else, right? And so I think that that's a common misconception, but I think that he's playing off of, you know, people's emotions by saying, you know, a wall and a border means that we are separating ourselves from them when we want to all be one together in the United States. And so obviously it's a positive message that he's trying to put out there, but he's doing it in a very extreme way. And I think when he's doing that, he's polarizing himself from other people who might actually agree with his initial stance that, yes, we should have legal immigration. But as you might think that, in the same article that you're referencing right now, his exact quote is, illegal immigration is a human right. Now, when I read that, I just couldn't get my mind around that, because I'm thinking to myself, how could illegal immigration be a human right? See, I'm all about immigration. Everybody in America is here because of immigration, and there's no arguing about them. There's no debate. It's just factual. And so the idea that illegal immigration is a human right is just simply not true. Being a legal immigrant shows that you have respect for our justice system, for our laws, and for our marketplace and everything that America stands for, right? And so what illegal immigration says to me is that you don't care enough about our values, you don't care enough about our system to come in here legally and become a contributing citizen. So
and what,
that's
what
my
really
take on that.
What strikes me about that particular quote that you mentioned is, okay, I might not agree with him, but if he's going to advocate for open borders, complete open borders, that's one thing. But if he's going to advocate for complete open borders, why wouldn't he just say that, you know, because under that system, all immigration would be legal, right? So why wouldn't why wouldn't he just make the point about how he wants 100% open borders instead of using the term illegal immigrants, which implies that no matter what the system is, if you come here illegally, then you should be allowed to stay. Even if we have 100% open borders, it just doesn't kind of make much sense to me. Anyhow.
Absolutely, I agree with you.
Real quick, swerving off of what you said, kind of about the legal immigration, and we want legal immigration. I agree with you 100% there. We always need legal immigration. In fact, if it weren't for legal immigration, right now our population growth would be negative right now.
Absolutely.
Because our birth rate is low, since many millennials don't seem to be settling down as quickly and having children. It's our growth numbers actually negative, but when you account for immigration, it's quite positive. So obviously, we need legal immigration for more than just economic reasons, you know, a lot of other reasons. But so that actually reminded me of our president is currently throwing around the terms like closing the border, and he's saying that he wants to close the border. And I don't have a lot of information on that personally, but it does
neither do I.
Based on what I've read about it, it does seem like he's pretty serious about this. And what's surprising to me is that even senators like Ted Cruz, for instance, who I'm a big fan of for the most part.
Me too. Yeah, I like Ted Cruz.
Like, for instance, Ted Cruz wasn't one of the senators who voted against Trump's emergency declaration. He supported him there. But he's drawing the line here, apparently, because he has made public statements saying that, no, Mr. President, closing the border would be economically hugely damaging, especially to border states like Texas and California, Nevada, Arizona, New Mexico. All of those would be very hit by this. So it's interesting because now that, again, I agree with the president on most issues. Not all. I definitely don't agree with him on some things, but I agree with our current president on quite a few issues. But this is one of those times where I have to see his statement on this and just wonder, you know, why he would decide to do this. Because, again, everyone has advisors. He has to have advisors telling him the implications of this. What I want to know is his exact motivation for closing the border. Because, because drug smugglers would still probably get through the parts that he wants to build a wall in where it's unsecured.
Oh, definitely.
But now he wants to stop the legal immigration and any U.S. citizens who are on the other... All I have to say is any U.S. citizens who are on the other side of our border with Mexico right now better get back quickly in case this goes out of control. Do you have any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I do. Really quick, anybody who's on vacation in Mexico right now better hop back on a plane and get over here before this does happen, if it does. I don't think it will, though. But my thoughts on this are similar to yours. Like you said, I do personally agree with a lot of the things that the president does say on certain policy issues as well. But there are things that I disagree with him with. But I would like to say this. With regards of closing the border, it's one of those things that I'm not necessarily sure if he is 100% serious about it. And let me kind of explain. A lot of people, even on the right, conservative and libertarian, I don't necessarily know if people give Trump credit when it comes to negotiation. And that might sound like a joke to some people, especially people who don't like Trump, because a lot of them don't believe that he was successful in business. But regardless of that, one of the things that really struck me and kind of showed me Trump's ability to negotiate with other countries and show that the U.S. does have dominance and have power is when he went the most recent summit with North Korea that just happened. I don't want to say the date because I could be wrong. But when that did go down, I do remember thinking that, you know, everybody was kind of surprised. Like, he went all the way down there, he met with Kim Jong-un, but yet he didn't close any deals or he didn't finalize anything. So what was the point of that? But, you know, if you really take a step back and you look at it from a strategic standpoint, he wanted to show Kim Jong-un that the U.S. would not get pushed around, and that just because he's going out there to discuss certain matters with him, that he's not just going to make a deal just because he's there. And I think that that's something that this country needs. I think this country needs to show that we're not going to be pushed around when it comes to certain trade deals or when it comes to denuclearization, as is with North Korea. And I think that's very, very important. And I think that that is kind of the same similar tactic that he might be enacting right now regarding to closing the southern border. Obviously, he's not going down to meet with the president of Mexico right now, but he's doing it over Twitter. But I still think he's kind of exercising that same type of negotiation skill, which is a very hardball type negotiation skill, by the way. It's not subtle at all, but I think that it's something that this country needs. I think people need to kind of get behind it, maybe not obviously close the border, but just kind of show, like, hey, you know what, if that's what it takes to get this issue across and to show how serious it is, maybe that is what we need to do. So in that light, I do actually kind of respect that, because there's a serious crisis going on the border, and people still do deny it, but I don't know. I mean, I think that if you just look at the facts, that you'd be very surprised at what's going on down there, and it's very horrible. So hopefully that will be fixed very, very soon.
I agree. So before we leave this segment and go into our commercial break, now is the part of the show where I comb through my my tweets and retweets of the past week to see what has surprised me or what's really of note, any real good insights, or what has made me very angry. So first we have, today actually, I saw a tweet that Ilhan Omar is pushing for the release of a jailed Muslim Brotherhood leader, saying that, I don't have a lot of information on this, give me a second. But basically, so Ilhan Omar is heavily lobbying for the release of a currently jailed Muslim Brotherhood leader. She says that she has said this through Twitter, saying that she hopes that Trump will bring up the case of this Muslim Brotherhood leader when he meets with the leader of Egypt right now. So that's an interesting development. That's what she's supporting, because again, you know, you believe what you want to believe, I'm all for that, but
absolutely,
seeing as how Ilhan Omar has a small history of not being necessarily the most tolerant person in Congress, and now
she is actually
advocating for the release of a known terrorist, then that's interesting to me. What do you have any thoughts on this?
You know, yeah, I'm not too familiar with the story myself, but I do know that that is something that is going on. I have heard that headline. I've seen it. But you know, the thing is that I don't know why that action is even tolerable in any way. I mean, is anybody calling her on this? I mean, I haven't been following it, like I said, but is anybody kind of calling her out and saying, you know, why do you want him released? You know, has anybody been kind of combating her claims here, or is that for why she's doing this?
No, so far it's fairly recent news. It only happened about 20 hours ago, so no one so far has questioned her on this. But I hope that we get some more information on that in the future.
Yeah, me too.
So continuing on through the rolling through the past week here. Can we real quick discuss AOC's Instagram Live that she did?
Oh yeah, the one where she was putting together IKEA furniture.
Yeah.
That one?
Yes.
Yeah. That one, see, the thing about that one, I didn't even watch that one. I didn't have the heart to watch that. There are only so many AOC videos I could take per day. My limit is about 2 right now. And so I did watch the first one I ever watched of her was a couple weeks back, maybe even a month ago, where she was like making making some type of food, and she was doing Instagram Live. Yeah, I don't know what she was doing. She was cutting something up. I think she was making some type of soup or something. But anyway, it was very strange to me.
This, I'm just an everyday lady kind of persona. Yeah, her, right. It's all. Honestly, though, politicians do this all the time. But she seems to be taking full advantage of social media to show everyone. Oh, look, I'm just an average Joe like you. You know, I'm just a regular person. Look at me build furniture and cook my dinner. Anyhow, continue.
Sorry. Yeah. Oh, no, yeah, and, you know, I think it's interesting because, like you just said, you know, she's playing very hard on that social media role, which is fine, but she is, I think her age really shows here, and there's nothing wrong with being young and being in Congress. I think that's a good thing if you actually have the logic behind you and if you actually have reason and purpose in there. I think right now everything she's saying has been proven to be factually incorrect, especially the Green New Deal. I did a whole article on that, but I won't talk about that, but... you know, the thing is even her tweets, when I read her tweets, it's almost as if I'm reading, you know, a 19-year-old girl's, Twitter rant about how much she hates Donald Trump. And it's just so interesting because, I don't know, just the rhetoric she uses in her tweets are just very, very immature. I don't really know how some people are getting behind her, because I feel like her base, the people who really, really support her, as me and you know, would be the DSA, the Democratic Socialists of America. You know, they're a very small group, but like you said, they're very, very vocal. And I also think that they're very, very young. When you, I don't know if you saw the video clip when the Green New Deal was released, when they had all those very young children go into the office of, I can't even think about who it was now. I think it was a senator. They went at the office of the senator and demanded that she would sign or that she would vote for, in favor of the Green New Deal. I don't know if you heard about that. Did you?
I did not, actually. That sounds interesting.
It was, and they were let in there by their teachers, right? So there was their teachers, and then there were students, and they were very young kids. And I was kind of surprised because these kids were like actually scared. Like you could see it on their faces and in their voices. Their voices were kind of shaky. Like they actually believed that the world was going to end in 12 years. Wow. And I'm thinking to myself, even if you are a big believer in climate change, I don't think people who are even 100% looking at the scientific data of climate change even believe that the world is going to end in 12 years. But here we have these very young kids, these very impressionable young kids, by the way, who are being led by their own teachers to believe this. I mean, it's like fear-mongering. I couldn't even believe that this even happened. And they went all the way to the senator's office. And it was very crazy to watch, like, the power that AOC has, especially over these young kids. And I think it's okay.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, very much.
Right. So I'm going to play a clip from her Instagram Live real quick.
Fantastic.
That was a clip of audio that I think is very interesting. Due to the system we have set up, you won't be able to hear it, but I send you the link. So listen to it while I play it for our guests. So for our listeners. It should be in the chat for the hosting service.
Gotcha. Okay. I'm checking it out right now.
Okay. Let me start this up, folks. Here we go.
How many years until the world ends again? We have 12 years left to cut emissions by at least 50%, if not more. And
to be clear, while she's saying this, she is crouching on the floor while apparently assembling furniture in the background and chewing popcorn.
Yes. And she's chewing very loudly as well. I'd like to point that out. She has no shame. She does not follow the rule of eat with your mouth closed. That's for sure.
Well, to be fair, though, she is trying to talk.
Yeah, she's trying to give us some very factual information about climate change.
Well, you know what's important? These things. I mean, if we're gonna die in 12 years, she doesn't have time to swallow the food before she can tell us this, right?
Exactly. Exactly. You're right. Exactly.
Make a joke about that. You may laugh, but your grandkids will not. So, understand that the internet documents everything. And for all those people, you know, you want to talk about looking in the back of history, looking backwards. You look back and you open history books on the civil rights movement, and you see those folks who are protesting against the ability for African Americans and Black Americans to have the right to vote.
Well, this definitely can't go wrong.
And they would
signs. I don't know how far the video is in the chat. But I just wanted to say she's very, very passionate here in this. And I think what she's trying to do is create her own civil rights movement, but obviously not with civil rights. But she's trying to start her own movement. I mean, I think it's very clear to see she's trying to become a figurehead for the climate change movement. That's what she wants. She wants to be remembered. It's just crystal clear. She wants to be remembered for that.
She's a figurehead right now, which you never know. Yeah. A lot of people probably would say she is.
Oh, absolutely.
So let's finish this video.
Hold up. Signs that said things like, what about white rights and like all of this stuff in the 1950s, 1960s. So just know that in the present day, there are a lot of people who hide the fact that their families and that their grandparents fought against principles of equal rights in the United States. Not 100 years ago, not 80 years ago.
I'm sure she'll get to her point.
But in this generation's lifetime.
It's been a very long time.
So just know that while a lot of people can hide that their grandparents did that in the civil rights movement.
Oh, buffering. I love buffering.
You should also know that the internet documents everything, and your grandchildren will not be able to hide the fact that you fought against acknowledging and taking bold actions on climate change. And people who are trying to mock and delay this moment, I mean, I just feel bad for you. I just pity you for
your role. I have so much to say about the ending of that video.
Yeah, well, it's Vince, she pities us. We have her pity.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that. She goes, I pity your position in history right now, and then opens her bag of almonds really, really loudly into the camera. And then it just ends. Very dramatic ending there.
Yes. Well, so it's official. She has compared climate change and the world and the quote, world ending in 12 years, as she says, to the civil rights movement and people protesting against African Americans. So,
you know,
it's true. She's making her own little movement here. And
yeah,
what I
definitely.
Think is the best, I love finding times when she tries to compare the Green New Deal or climate change to some big event like that. This is not the first time that she's compared climate change to the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s.
Not at all. Not at all.
So, it's, well, you know.
She actually, the day that she announced that the world was going to end in 12 years, by the way, I still have yet to find that study. Like I said, I wrote an article about the Green New Deal, my review of it, and I was looking for that article, for that scientific research that she said. She said, according to scientists, the world's going to end in 12 years, right? So I was like, wow, like I got to find this study, and I couldn't find anything. So I kind of think she just said it, but you know, I could be wrong. Maybe it's out there somewhere. Anyway, the day she said that was on Martin Luther King Day at a conference. And right after, she followed that up with, she said that this was our generation's World War II. I thought that was just crazy as well. That was like, it's definitely not. It's definitely not our World War II. Well,
to be fair, if she genuinely believes, and I mean if she believes 100% without a doubt that the world is going to end in 12 years, then, I mean, World War II is a stretch. But if she actually believes the entire world is going to end, literally end, in 12 years, then she, I'm not surprised that she's using these types of analogies. But the problem is, as you said, that there's no study that says this. In fact, no studies confirm this. And again, if there were a study to confirm it, we would have to look at the methodology behind it. We'd have to look at what time period it was done in and which, the timeline that it was done in, and who worked on it, whether it was peer-reviewed as true or not. And if that all checked out, then, honestly, maybe the world would end in 12 years. But again, there's nothing to prove this, so my frustration with this is just that no one, unfortunately, seems to truly realize that this is just fear-mongering. Yes, climate change
absolutely.
Is an issue. Climate change is an issue. And yes, we can be doing more than we are right now to
I agree.
Stop our impact on the environment. The environment is important.
Yes.
but it's not so important that we need to reduce our country to, as I called it on my show a few weeks ago, a Amish paradise where everyone, you know, where the nation is devoid of industry. Because let's not forget that China and India are still pumping out gallons of pollution a second compared to us in ratio. So even if we actually a study was released that even if we as America cut down our pollution by the same amount that the Green New Deal claims it will, again, whether or not it will actually do what it says is debatable, but let's say that it works flawlessly, we will still not truly stop the world from ending in 12 years, if that is indeed true, which it isn't, because we have all these other countries just belching out pollution. So again, that's the end of my little rant there. But now let's move on to a quick ad break before we go on to the rest of our show. So if you'll give me 1 second here, we can get on that. Let's try. Give me a second. All right, Vince, I'll talk to you again in a few minutes. Let's go to our ad break. With so much content whizzing around out there, there's only one storytelling platform that helps you keep calm and stay informed and inspired. Flipboard. Flipboard curates the world's stories so that you can be smarter in your work, life, and play. Choose from thousands of topics to personalize Flipboard and get the latest stories from the best publishers and experts delivered to you 24/7. When you see stories that you want to save or share, tap the plus button and add them to private or public collections. It's that simple. Used by millions of people every day, Flipboard is how people move themselves and the world forward. Get started now at Flipboard.com. That's Flipboard.com. Have you ever thought about starting your own podcast? When I was trying to get this podcast off the ground, as well as the rest of Bipartisan Media, I had a lot of questions. How do I record an episode? How do I get my show into all the apps people like to listen on? How do I make money for my podcast? The answer to every one of these questions is really simple. Anchor. Anchor is a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing your podcast. Best of all, it's 100% free and ridiculously easy to use. And now Anchor can match you with great sponsors who want to advertise on your podcast. That means that you can get paid to podcast right away. In fact, that's what I'm doing right now by reading this ad. So if you've always wanted to start a podcast and make money doing it, go to anchor.fm/start to join me and the diverse community of podcasters already using Anchor. That's anchor.fm/start. I can't wait to hear your podcast. Welcome back to Jonesing for Liberty. I'm Rod Jones, and with me again is Vince Gordon. Yes, I am as well. So now we'll be moving into our segment titled Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness, which is where we will talk about liberty theory and basically about all these concepts related to the libertarian movement. So let's open it up and get it started.
That they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
So, today's discussion for Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness is going to be on free global trade and tariffs. Now, first, what I'd like to touch on is globalism versus economic globalism, a common misconception with libertarians that support free global trade, which should be all of them, is that they support globalism and that they support the UN, and basically that they support the general globalist movement. However, that is not true. There is a difference between globalism and economic globalism. I'm not speaking for all libertarians, as we have a very, very diverse community of people who have very different beliefs. And again, the one thing that all libertarians have in common is that the government shouldn't have control over your life. So that's why today we're going to be talking about this economic side of things. Again, globalism is not what most libertarians believe. They do not like the UN, they do not like international governing bodies, and they really don't like other people, especially governments that we did not elect, telling us what to do. But what a lot of us do like is economic globalism, and I'm sure most of our audience will agree with that. But let me just describe that real quick for you. Free trade, basically, is what we're talking about here, meaning that each business will be free to sell the products in any country of the world, and that in return, any business will be able to import their products to the U.S., etc. Basically, the free movement of goods and peoples. So now that I've kind of cleared that up, hopefully, let's talk about the trade deficit, because that's probably one of the most common arguments for not non-free trade, in other words, which normally takes the form of tariffs, which the general idea behind those seems to make sense, which is basically that our company in America is hurting because they can't make things as well or as efficiently as a company in China, and that can be for any number of reasons. But let's say they're making robots. The American company can't make as many robots or as good quality of robots as China can. However, if we implement a tariff, then that means that we will make the price of both goods equal, which means that you can either buy an American robot or a Chinese robot, but most of the time tariffs don't just make them equal, they make the foreign product more expensive. So it encourages people to purchase American items, but I'll be going through why that's not necessarily a good thing, and hopefully Vince will be able to have a good discussion with me on this. So first thing is a trade deficit that I want to discuss, because that's a pretty common argument, is that, well, look at us, we're importing way more than we're exporting. America shouldn't be importing way more than it's exporting. But the best response, one of the best response I've found to the argument of trade deficit, is the grocery store analogy. Everyone has a trade deficit with a grocery store. You're not going to go into the grocery store, sell them some bread, and then buy some lunch meat. You go into the grocery store to buy what you need, and in exchange you give the grocery store money. That's the basic principle of trade. Everyone has a trade deficit with nearly all the stores they visit. But it really doesn't matter, because, as we can see, having a personal trade deficit with the grocery store doesn't affect my life whatsoever. Vince, actually, I'm going to bring you on again. Do you have anything to say in the topic of trade deficit before we get into the larger discussion of tariffs?
Well, I don't know if I have anything to say as far as, you know, before we get into tariffs. I do obviously support free trade. I think it's a great idea. I think it's a great thing. You know, the only thing, I don't know, I might want to hold off until we get to the tariffs, though, because I feel like that's maybe my only differing issue with you on that one.
All right, sounds good. So let's move on to the tariffs. So the common arguments for tariffs, one of them is, what about sweatshops, you know? Before I get to that, let me go through a couple bulleted points I have here about why free global trade especially, is needed and is a good thing. One of the many yeah. reasons, again, I'm not going to have time to go through them all, but one of the many reasons is that there's a less likelihood of war between two countries. if China is shipping, is heavily invested in our economy, as they are now, and we are invested in their economy, even if it's to a lesser extent than they are invested in ours, then there's a much lower likelihood that either of us would declare war on each other. Because businesses are powerful, and they can lobby. And if they feel, and if a major business, who most of their business is done in America, even if the company's based in China, if one of those businesses feel that there's a danger of China going to war with the U.S. and thus disrupting their business, then they are going to heavily lobby their government to not go to war with the U.S., and vice versa with U.S. companies and war with China. So overall, there's a less likelihood of war between nations with free trade. And this entire argument I'm going to be going through is going to be avoiding most of the economics of it, actually, because there's just so much to go through in that. So I'm going to make a real quick point right now, and then I'll let Vince talk for a second. So another great argument in favor of free trade is specialization and cheap prices. Basically, what I'm talking about here is that the idea that each country will automatically, in a free world trade system, trend towards a few types of industry that it excels at for whatever reason. And that means that each country will be able to produce certain goods the most efficiently, depending on what they have decided, what they are able to specialize in. So if America makes steel better than China, then our steel is going to, in a ideal free global trade world, then our steel would go to all the countries around us because we make the best steel in our side of the world. However, if China makes better robots than us, then we will have more Chinese robots because those robots are cheaper and higher quality, just like our steel is cheaper and higher quality than Chinese steel. Again, these aren't real-world examples. I don't actually know the economics behind whether our steel is better and or cheaper than Chinese steel, but for argument's sake, this is the example I'm using. And so that specialization leads to cheaper prices, because the more efficiently a country can produce a certain type of good, the cheaper it will be for consumers all around the world to buy it, and it will boost the global economy significantly. So, Vince, I'm going to take a quick 3-minute break here. If you can talk about your views on tariffs, I'll be back in a few minutes.
Absolutely, not a problem, man. So, you know, I think one of the things when it comes to, you know, free global trade and tariffs is that free trade is very important for many reasons. One of them being that, like you said, it does reduce the likelihood of war if all countries are trading fairly and not necessarily equally, because like you said, when you go to the grocery store, you don't always need everything in the grocery store, you get what you need. So I just think that as long as everything is on a fair level playing field, then free trade will work. But obviously in the real world, that doesn't always happen. And I think that that's one of the biggest things that we've been seeing going on when it has come to the trade war with China. You know, Donald Trump has put tariff after tariff on certain products from China. And I think that the reason he's doing this is, like I said, once again, his negotiation skills. He's doing it to show that he's not just going to say that he wants to make trade deals better with China. I think what he's doing is he's trying to show that he's willing to take action in order to do so, and he's going to make them hurt if he needs to. And same thing with the United States. If we need to take a little bit of a hit on a certain area, we might need to do that in order for better free trade in the future. So I think that what's really important is getting on a fair, equal level playing ground when it comes to fair trade. That way, every single party is able to benefit from fair and free trade. Now, like I said about tariffs, I don't necessarily think tariffs are a long-term sustainable answer for goods. And the reason is because they would always have to change regarding price, and it would definitely inflate prices as well. And I think it would make the market go crazy worldwide. And so I think that tariffs might be okay as a bargaining chip and as a tool to maybe get fair trade agreements, or fair trade agreements that are more fair, I should say. But I don't think that they're sustainable long-term. So I do support tariffs for maybe negotiation tactics, but I don't support them for long-term use, because I think free trade wins overall. And just like Rod said, specialization and cheap prices overall is going to really work when it comes to free trade, because every country has a specialty in producing something, whether it be automobiles, whether it be agricultural products, whatever it is, one country is better at it than another one. And so it's in all countries' best interest that they produce what they're best at producing with their limited resources. So yeah, that's what I have to say about free trade and tariffs.
All right, and I have to say, for the most part, I definitely agree with you there. Some great points. Thank you, Vince. So before we go and leave the life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness segment of our show, I want to talk about the argument about sweatshops. Because, again, one of the major arguments for tariffs seems to be, well, what about China's sweatshops? You know, I mean, let's say people in Mexico, even, are working in a sweatshop, and they have terrible health regulations. Paid pennies an hour, and really are just, you know, living in terrible conditions. Then that company who hires those people is going to be able to produce something significantly cheaper than an American company burdened by things like health regulations, safety regulations, and minimum wage. And I have a couple responses to that. The first of which is, yes, and that's unfortunate. And basically, what this is talking about is how it's unfortunate. Because really, in a free trade system, it might seem like you'll have all of these sweatshops popping up everywhere all around the world to flood our market with cheap goods, and then all of our companies will be outcompeted in the major market and collapse and die. And that seems like a pretty dire situation. However, one of the effects of free global trade is that it allows people to enrich themselves in other countries by shipping goods to another country. And generally, the wealthier someone is, the more educated they are and the more they know about things. And of course, you have unionization is always an issue. One of the other responses I have to this are that we definitely need to eliminate a lot of the policies that make producing things so expensive in the U.S. I'm not advocating for something stupid like no more safety or health regulations, because I believe in minimal regulation, not no regulation. But I believe that each company should decide its own company-wide minimum wage, and it shouldn't be mandated by the government. I believe that each company shouldn't be mandated by the government to provide health care to its employees. I believe that they should choose what level and whether or not they want to provide health care to the employees in the first place. And I also, however, I do agree with safety regulations. That is something that needs to stay in place for the most part, although there are a few pieces of red tape we could cut in that area. And so for some people listening, this might seem like a pretty controversial idea, but let me flesh this out a little more real quick for you. Basically, if we give companies the freedom to choose health care for their employees and to choose their own company-wide minimum wage, it might seem like, oh, those greedy owners of the businesses are just going to pay people $1 an hour and give them no health care, and all the employees will suffer and die of starvation. And that's a pretty apocalyptic scenario there, and I definitely don't want to live in a world where that happens. But the problem is, that's not what's going to happen if we eliminate stuff like minimum wage laws and healthcare regulations for companies. And the reason why is simply that if one company, or rather, it will, briefly, before I go into the slightly longer explanation, it will make hiring more competitive. It will make labor, cutting these regulations will make labor more valuable, because, you know, if you're working at a minimum wage job right now, you could be working at a fast food restaurant flipping burgers. And at the same time, you could choose between doing that or perhaps bagging stuff at a grocery store or working at a grocery store. Now, it really depends on, in that scenario, which job you want more, because they pay you the exact same and the benefits are likely very, very, very similar. However, in our scenario, whichever companies would have motivation to have high company-wide minimum wages and to have good health care, because, again, labor is always a necessity for business, and labor would be valued more if we didn't have these minimum wage laws in place. Because if Starbucks, say, decides to have a company-wide minimum wage of $15 an hour, and Walmart has a company-wide minimum wage of $10 an hour, then you're likely going to want to work for Starbucks because they pay you more. Companies aren't going to just pay people terrible amounts of money, like a dollar an hour or less, because if they do that, they will not find any employees willing to work for them, because other companies will wisen up and see, oh look, Starbucks is only paying their employees $1 an hour. We had better raise our company-wide minimum wage, because that means that we will be able to hire the employees that we need, and Starbucks, our competitor, let's use Dunkin' Donuts as an example for this, then Starbucks, their competitor, will then have a massive labor shortage and will not have enough employees to do anything and will likely go out of business. So companies in this scenario will have massive motivation to have relatively high and competitive company-wide minimum wages and good health care. So that's pretty much the end of my little rant on that. And this leads seamlessly, I would like to say, but not really. It leads us into our next full discussion on the minimum wage. So now, let's go to our economics quarter, where we will discuss the economics behind the minimum wage and why the minimum wage in general is a bad idea. So I know I've probably already sort of trampled onto the ground to discuss this topic, but Vince, what are your thoughts on this?
Sure. So really quickly, going back to sweatshops, I would have to say that, you know, what's really interesting about the economics of that is that the idea that, you know, obviously sweatshops are horrible to work in, horrible environment, and they get paid very little. But when you look at the choices of work that these other people have to deal with, instead of maybe working in a sweatshop in these other countries, maybe such as like Cambodia, there's things like prostitution, there's scavenging for items to sell, there's begging, and et cetera, right? And so these are actually their best options in this case, right? Like you pointed out as well. So I think what actually is really shown here when we're looking at sweatshops is the idea of how important the freedom, or how important economic freedom actually is. Because, you know, the United States, Germany, and Great Britain used to have, you know, sweatshops, but we just called them factories, right? I mean, they had horrible working conditions. They were getting paid very, very little. There was also the child labor laws and everything like that that happened. And so what happened was, is after the United States became more economically free and institutions started recognizing the rights of private property and the rule of law was enforced, things got a lot better for the working people. So I just like to point that out. I think that's very important. And like you said, leading into, you know, the minimum wage, you know, my opinion and my take on the minimum wage is this. As you already covered, that, you know, when you raise the minimum wage, you're going to increase the competition for that job. And, the economic term for a job like that, that you'd be getting paid minimum wage for, is what's called unskilled labor. Maybe you're working at McDonald's, Home Depot, Walmart, Target, whatever. You're working at a job that you don't necessarily need a college degree for or anything. You can get it right out of high school or even in high school, and you can start working that job, right? So here's the thing about raising minimum wage in this whole war, pay 15, right? That's the whole movement. It's been going on for a couple of years now. See, the problem with that is that, you know, when you raise minimum wage, you're going to have a lot of people get fired right when that happens. And especially when you do the national minimum wage, obviously states minimum wage raise from time to time, and it actually kind of happens periodically. I know Ohio, which is where I live, I know that's actually happened very recently. I think like twice in the last 2 years, I believe, so once a year. But anyway, getting to my point here, you know, a little statistic that when minimum wage was raised in around the late 2000s by 30%, so it's pretty significant, 1.4 million workers lost their job because there was more competition and business owners were now forced to pay people more money for doing the same job that they were doing before. And as horrible as this might sound, not every worker is as efficient as the next guy, right? So sometimes you have one worker who's really good at their job. Sometimes you have someone who's maybe mediocre and one guy who's not really doing too good. And when you're a business owner, as much as you'd want to help people out and give people a job, you have to think, you know, economically based, financially based, right? Because it is your business and you need to make a profit in order to be successful and to grow. And so you're going to have to cut that last guy off who wasn't performing as well as the other guys. So I think that that's really something that people need to take into consideration, because while, yes, the people who keep their jobs will be making, say, $15 an hour, for working, you know, the cost of the inputs are going to also rise as well, because now the people who are making the inputs of the product that you're selling also have to pay their workers $15 minimum, right? And so I think it's really important to point that out because, you know, small businesses that have less than 500 employees make up 99% of the American economy, as far as like GDP production, right? And so it's important to recognize that these small business owners would have to lay off a lot of people just to make ends meet. And
what's
so
really sad is restaurants. Every time you see minimum wage raises in local areas or in states, restaurants are always hit the hardest because they have, if you look at the economics behind restaurants, first of all, public service announcement to all of our listeners, never, ever, ever, ever become a restaurateur. Never own a restaurant. It's a terrible business to be in, and here's why. The profit margins are so razor thin in restaurants because of, you have to... You have to factor in building expenses. You have to factor in food expenses. But the largest, by far the largest expense for them is labor, because they have to have all these waiters and waitresses running around all the time, making sure that their customers' needs are met. At the same time, they have to have cooks in the back. They have to have various levels of cooks. They have to have manager. They have to have someone who will seat you at your table. And all of those people really add up, because they have to have... they have to have benefits if they're full-time employees, even if they're minimum wage. They have to be paid a certain amount because of the minimum wage laws. And it really hurts them, because every time you drive up the minimum wage, restaurants, again, are the hardest hit. Because their profit margins are so razor thin because of labor, if you raise the minimum wage by even like 25 cents an hour, then a lot of employees are going to have their hours cut back, even if they're not fired. Which means they will no longer be considered full-time employees, which means legally, businesses don't have to provide them with healthcare. And again, I'm sure that 90% of business owners are not ruthless people. They actually care about their employees, and that's what makes it so much worse. As you were saying,
absolutely.
Vince, because, again, these aren't heartless people. A lot of them care about their employees, but they have to make decisions to ensure their well-being as well. And so when minimum wage laws come into force, generally across the board hours are cut, but especially in restaurants, they turn to an entire staff of part-time workers or mostly a large number of part-time workers, so they don't have to give them as many benefits because that is just more economical for them. And so in the end, minimum wage especially hurts restaurants, but in really hurts everyone involved in the retail and industrial industry. Because it forces businesses to cut back hours or to fire employees, and it as you were saying, 1.4, I believe you said 1.4 million, Vince, people got laid off after the
minimum. Yeah, 1.4 million, yeah.
In the early 2000s? So...
Yeah, late 2000s, actually.
Late 2000s, so...
Early 2000s, yeah. I don't even know why I said late. Early 2000s,
yeah,
sorry.
2000s. So it's just a really sad fact that minimum wage increases, as much as the goal is to help people, really, in the end, wind up hurting people so much. And that's why it's really important that as many people as possible really either do their own research or listen to shows like this so that they can really know the truth about the minimum wage. Because all the proponents of the minimum wage, all they'll talk about is they'll use emotion with you, and they'll talk about, oh, we have to fight the power. We need to get our minimum wage because those greedy owners of the businesses aren't going to give us what we want unless we make them give us what we want. And the sad thing is all these people get riled up by these union leaders, and they unionize and go on strike and demand higher minimum wages, and a bunch of them end up getting fired. So that's pretty much my bit about the minimum wage. Do you have anything else to say, Vince?
Let me check my notes really quick, because I think I covered everything as far as raising the minimum wage goes. Let's see. Yeah, I mean, you definitely cover the fact that, you know, the disadvantaged worker definitely gets hurt more, obviously, because, you know, the higher the wage, the more productive they need to be. And also, I think another interesting thing to point out is that when minimum wage increases across the board, that older people start to come maybe out of retirement in order to make more money, because the wage is so competitive at that point that they're thinking, why don't I get back out there because it's so high, right? So when you go from something like, I don't want to, you know, give a false statistic here, but I know that our national minimum wage is actually very low compared to 15. Like, I'm pretty sure it's like 7 something. And so if you more than double that, I mean, that's going to be a disastrous effect on the economy right there. And so you're going to see so much competition for these lower level unskilled labor jobs. And I just don't think that's a good thing for anybody. And like you said, perfectly sums it up, is that it ends up hurting the small guy versus the guy who's on top of the business. It actually hurts everybody involved, right? So that's the problem with raising the minimum wage and even necessarily even having one at that point.
Definitely, definitely. Yeah. And it's sadly controversial that that getting rid of the minimum wage altogether is such a controversial issue. It's pretty sad to me. But moving on, we are now going into our libertarian update. Jonesing for Liberty, Libertarian Update. Let's get into it. Today's Libertarian Update is Justin Amash running for president in 2020, possibly. And if he would, most likely under the Libertarian Party name. So according to Reason.com, and I'll get, actually, that reminds me, after our last discussion here with Vince before we end the show, I really want to just bring up a few really interesting people to follow on Twitter, if you have Twitter, Instagram, and then a few really amazing news sources and YouTube channels that I love as a libertarian. But first, let's get into this story. So according to Reason, Justin Amash said that he's not ruling out running for president in 2020 as a libertarian. And he says, looking at the details from this article, it's kind of funny because it seems that he was speaking at an event, and he was asked to describe the ideal libertarian candidate, and people are pointing out that, whether purposefully or inadvertently, a lot of the qualities that he was stating in terms of policy and stuff like that were almost spot on with Justin Amash himself. And then that's led to the question, would you run for president in 2020? And he says he's not ruling it out and that he would consider it. And so real quick, before we get into discussing this, Vincent, for people who don't know who Justin Amash is, he is currently a representative in the U.S. Congress. He's a Republican, but he is very, very libertarian in his votes and his policy decisions. And so I'm actually a big fan of him because he's not just a libertarian and he doesn't just align with my beliefs, but most of what he says is very common sense, and he's not one of those people who I really hate that just try to tear down the other side and make them look stupid, but rather he actually engages in meaningful discussion with people. Like I enjoy helping facilitate here Bipartisan Media. He really engages in meaningful conversations with people and really is a nice person overall. That's the impression I get from him, as well as being a common sense guy who also is libertarian. So, Vince, do you know much about this story? And if so, do you have any opinions on it? Anything to say?
Yeah, so I've actually read up on that article, and I have heard about him a little bit. I definitely agree with you. He is very libertarian. Leaning, and I think that's actually a good thing, you know, to have. You got to have some diversity in the Republican Party, right? I think that it's really interesting as well. Like from the article I read, there was a couple things that I really agreed with that he said. The first one was that he said that partisanship rhetoric needs to die. Absolutely, 100%. I think that at the end of the day, you know, it's like you can be on one side of the aisle and you can be on another one. That's fine, right? But we're all trying to get on the same, we're trying to get to the same place, which is a better America, right, for everybody who's living in it. And so the idea that one party is going to, the idea that one party gets a victory and the other party loses is just not true, right? If you look at the border wall, the idea that if the wall gets built, that Trump wins and Republicans win, but Democrats lose. It's like, well, no, because we're all going to win. We're going to have a safer America. You know, less overdoses, I would assume, right? Less sex trafficking, better border security. Who doesn't want that? Well, I guess the answer is the Democrats, right? But anyway, I would have to say that with all this partisanship rhetoric going on, that it's important that we always focus on the common ground underlying issue that I think America is the greatest country in the world. And even if you don't believe that, the whole idea is that we want to get it there, right? We want to make it the best that it could possibly be. Right. And so I think that whether you agree with somebody on one issue or disagree, right, you should be respectful, civil about it. It's okay to crack jokes now and then, but don't turn it into a political party of winning and losing one versus the other. You know, for example, one of the most, like, I would say recent examples of this, right, party versus party, is with the border wall. And I know I already brought it up, but if you look back at the past two presidents, if you look back at Obama and you look back at Bush, they both tried to get border security, border security legislation passed that would actually secure the border and make it better. Not necessarily build a wall, but they wanted to make border security a priority, right? And
right.
Bush was obviously a Republican and Obama was obviously a Democrat. And neither of them got what they wanted. And now Trump's trying to do it again. And I think the mistake that Trump's made, is that he's kind of helped it turn into another party against party issue, when in reality, it's just about everybody's safety in the country.
Right.
And so I think that if it was approached as like a libertarian, from a libertarian point of view, that we need safety for everybody. It's not just for Republicans and for Democrats, it's for everyone. I think if it was approached in that light, people would be much more accepting of the whole idea. But I think because of all this partisan rhetoric, it's not helping the situation at all, and it's doing more harm than good. And, and that's all I have to say actually about Justin Amash, because that was a big point of his in this article. And I actually, there's a video in there where he's being interviewed, and I really liked it. And I think he'd be an interesting presidential candidate as well. I think he would be pretty interesting to see him run against Trump. And I think he would obviously do very well along with libertarians. I think he would do very, very well with them. But yeah, I overall liked what he had to say.
Oh yeah. And on your point there real quick before I move on, something that's very, a very simple concept, but I think is too many people miss in today's society, and something that I think is really, really important, is that, as you said, both parties, in fact, I say both parties, all parties, everyone in America wants a better America. Everyone in America wants less crime. Everyone in America wants to be happier, and everyone in America wants to ensure success for people. The only difference between the parties is that the people have different ideas of how to get there, which we vehemently disagree on sometimes. But the point is as you said, Vince, it's important to remember, everyone wants to build a better America. No one on the other side actually wants to destroy America or to hurt people. They never actually want to do that, I would hope. And I know for sure that a lot of them don't. But as you said, no one actually wants bad things for America. We just have different ideas of how to get there. And so that is why it's important to have discussions, and why it's important to really flesh out ideas before going off on someone for a small comment that you disagree with. So moving on, we are going to go on to one of our last part of today's podcast, which is our discussion. Today, Vince has proposed to me the topic, the topic of, is it a crime to be successful in America, and why capitalism is being targeted more than ever? So, Vince, why don't you get us started off on this, since it is your topic idea?
For sure, yeah, thank you. So, my whole life, I've always been fascinated by business of all kinds. That's just how I was. My uncle owns a business, and so it kind of runs in the family. And I've just always been interested in it, right? And I've always loved the idea of being able to start your own business or work for somebody else, but be able to kind of build yourself up and maybe bring yourself out of your current financial situation in life. And see, the whole idea is that you can create something out of nothing. And you can only do that in America. And that is true. And a lot of people try and say, well, maybe you could do it now in other, in Western Europe now. But I really don't necessarily think that's the case. I still think America is number one when it comes to entrepreneurship and building a business. And I think that the horrible thing that we're seeing right now is Amazon, Apple, Microsoft, the biggest companies, right, are just getting demonized by the left. And the reason I'm pointing out the left is because it's not happening on the right at all. I mean, it's really not happening on the right at all. Everybody that I follow on the right, everybody that I talk to who is right-leaning in any way has nothing against capitalism, nothing against business at all, or free trade anything that has to do with capitalism at all. Nobody has anything against it. And here's my biggest issue with demonizing capitalism as a whole. When you pick a certain business, and lately it's been Amazon, they've been under quite a lot of bit of fire. And when you pick one business out of the entire market system and you use that as the model as why it doesn't work, that's ridiculous. You have to look at the system as a whole, right? And so if you look at capitalism as a whole, you see in record numbers that it has brought more people out of poverty than any other economic system in the entire world, right? Since civilization. 100%. And so I think that that's almost all anyone needs to know, right? I mean, before you even try to make the argument that capitalism doesn't work, if you know that fact, you know that it does. And now I'm not saying that capitalism doesn't need to evolve. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying that you need to still have the same firm foundation of capitalism. And I think that what's happening here is that with Amazon, because they are so successful, and they have been, honestly, a fairly fast company in as far as reaching their level of success, I would say. But because of that, they're under a lot of scrutiny, and there's a lot to do with, oh man, Jeff Bezos is so greedy. He doesn't pay his employees well enough. But actually, that's not even true, because if you look it up, he employs over 600,000 people, and he pays everybody a base of $15 an hour, which once again, ironically enough, is what everybody wants to be paid. Right. So the real question is, instead of demonizing capitalism and saying, pay me $15 an hour, and you're telling that to McDonald's or Walmart, why don't you just go get a job at Amazon? Exactly. The company's continuing to grow. It's going to continue to grow. It's not going to stop. They're in every single industry that you could imagine.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they're getting into movies and everything. Yeah, it's crazy. And so, you know, the last point of this that I want to bring up is, like I said, ever since I was young, I've been into business. And I've read books about entrepreneurship, like autobiographies. My favorite book of all time is it's Ray Kroc's autobiography. And he's the founder of McDonald's. He's the guy who met the two brothers who started the first McDonald's restaurant, and then he expanded it into a franchise. For me, that has just been the most motivating business story ever, and I love reading it. And it's a great book, so I highly suggest anybody listening check it out, especially you, Rod. I think you'd like it. Once again, it's Ray Kroc, his autobiography.
All right, I'll check it out.
And so anyway, about this book, when I read things like that, it really inspires me, because it shows you that you can come from nothing. He was in his 50s when he even started franchising McDonald's and turning it into the biggest real estate business. And a lot of people think McDonald's makes its money from its food, but it doesn't. It makes its money from franchising and owning real estate. And the point there is that the American dream is alive and well. Some people don't think it is. I think the American dream is alive and well, but if we start putting restrictions on it, if we start moving towards a socialized government, it's not going to happen. And that's the problem that I have with socialism, is that it's all about hating the rich. And I'm gonna have to say it, I guess, at some point. So I don't think there's anything wrong with being rich. Nothing at all. If you have a lot of money, that means that you worked hard, right?
Right.
Unless you've obviously inherited the money. Okay. But if you've earned the money, that means that you worked hard for it, or at least worked, right, in general. And so here's the thing. There's a difference between being rich, and there's a difference between being greedy. And it's not really a fine line. You can have money and you could give generously. But you could also have a lot of money and be kind of, you know, stingy with it and not help anyone out. But then again, it is your money to do what you want with it.
Right.
You know, we can't forget about that. But at the same time, the idea that every rich person, every person who drives a Mercedes or a Tesla or whatever is evil, it blows my mind. Because it's like, isn't that what everybody ends up wanting to achieve at least in some point in their life? I mean,
yeah.
If you look at all the, you know, the Hollywood liberals, right? They all have very nice houses, very nice cars, very nice jewelry, whatever, clothes. And yet they talk so much about income inequality. They talk so much about capitalist greed, you know? It's just like, you guys are benefiting off the system, yet you're talking about how horrible it is. And it's very interesting to me. And on my final note with that, I'd like to end that with this, is saying that I recently started reading Ben Shapiro's new book, The Right Side of History. And one of the things he says in the very beginning, yeah, it's actually really good so far. I'm about halfway through it, so I'll let you know how it is. But, you know, in the beginning of the book, he says that right now, living in America, we are living the best that anyone in history of civilization has ever lived. And I think that's very true. You could be not poor, obviously, but you could be in a very lower income tax bracket and still live a very decent life, right? Okay. Now, you're not going to be living comfortably, driving BMWs, living in a nice gated community, obviously, but you're still living with immense freedom. I mean, immense freedom, like beyond people's wildest imaginations in other countries. And when you think about it, that all comes from capitalism. That all comes from fair competition and from an equal level playing field market, right? That is what fueled and has created everything in here. So that was what I wanted to say. And I think that it's a shame that capitalism is being targeted as evil. And I think that the fact that someone who, I feel like some people might even be afraid to say that they want to be successful, you know, that maybe say, you know, I'd like to be a millionaire someday. You know, I maybe like to have $10 million. I feel like there's going to be a time in the near future where saying that you're going to be seen as greedy, you're going to be seen as evil. And I really hope that doesn't happen. But the more we move closer, the more the left moves closer to this, I think it's inevitable. And I think it's horrible. I think it's a real shame.
All right. So a few points before we end. First, on your McDonald's, I haven't read the autobiography, but I really want to. What I have seen is the Netflix documentary on him.
Yes.
And
yes.
That was very interesting as well. Really, really interesting story. Love that. And what you were saying about... I lost my train of thought, but right, what you were saying about the income inequality and Ben Shapiro's book. Again, I haven't read his most recent book yet, but I have heard excerpts from it, and I know that he makes the point that the like you were saying, some of the poorest people in America right now are living better than people who are considered well off in, say, the Renaissance or when our country was first founded. The living standard is so drastically increased that even if you're pretty poor and you're living in a tiny studio apartment, let's say you're just out of college, student loan debt, living in a tiny studio apartment, as I believe he says in his book, you have most likely a microwave, a refrigerator, and a sink, running water, toilet, shower, all those things, and also likely a television, as well as a bed and chairs and a couch somewhere in your apartment. You are likely to have the majority of those things. And again, because of the pace of invention, because of capitalism fueling invention, we have progressed so far in such a short period of time, it's almost mind-blowing. If you look at some of the, because I'm personally a history geek, and if you look at some historians, it is absolutely mind-boggling that the entirety of the history of the universe in the past 300, 500 years, where so much, especially in the past 300 years, where so much change and innovation has taken place because capitalism was introduced in as a main idea about roughly 300 years ago into certain countries. The sheer amount of change and inventions and rapidly increasing quality of life is mind-boggling in the past 300 years compared to the rest. I mean, you had tens of thousands of years where people were living in huts, growing their own food, dying at the age of 40, and all of a sudden, within 300 years, we go from living in Renaissance era. Prior to the Industrial Revolution, where people are still, even though they have a higher quality of life, they're living in terrible sanitary conditions and with relatively low standards of living, all the way up to now, where, as I said, even a relatively poor person has tons of amenities that make their life better. So, and it's that right there is really the best argument for capitalism, that we had tens of thousands of years of such slow technological advancement, and that as soon as capitalism was discovered as the best system for an economy, that the rapid
pace of change has been amazing. So that's what I'll end today's episode on. Before I go, as I said, I want to send a shout out to some wonderful people and channels that you should follow on YouTube. Follow Reason TV, and Reason also has a website that I quoted earlier, reason.com. They have a magazine with some very insightful articles on it. Great stuff. I love stuff, especially the YouTube channel, though. It's very amazing. If you're a fan of podcasts like this one, I strongly suggest Andrew Heaton's program. If you haven't heard of him before, he's a libertarian who used to work for Conservative Review, and now they've merged with The Blaze, so he works for them now. But he is a libertarian, and he has a show called what is it exactly? Well, I don't want to get the name wrong, but Andrew Heaton is a very interesting guy. He's written a book called Laughter is Better Than Communism. It's a political book, but it's really funny. And so he's a great guy. If you check out his podcast, I'm looking it up right now. Something's Off with Andrew Heaton. That's his podcast. It's free. I strongly encourage you to listen to that if you like what you heard on today's program. Don't forget to check out the rest of Bipartisan Media by going to our website, bipartisanmedia.com, and looking at all of our other shows we offer. Check out Vince Gordon's amazing article he wrote on the Green New Deal in conjunction with a few others at the what is the exact address? Vince, do you remember? It's studentpost.org, I believe, or the Student Post.
I believe. Let me check for it. I think it's studentpost.org.
Studentpost.org.
Yep, it's so studentpost. Yep.
Studentpost.org. They're our partner. They're partnered with Bipartisan Media. And lots of great articles. I write for them, Vince writes for them, and a lot of other great authors there. Whether or not you agree with all of the opinions expressed, because this is a bipartisan organization, they have lots of more left-leaning writers as well as lots of more conservative and libertarian writers. In fact, I have an article that should go up there. That's a very theoretical article, but it should be pretty interesting. That should be going up within the next few days. So check out that, studentpost.org, and check out bipartisanmedia.com. for our website. And thank you, everyone, so much for listening to this the second episode of Jonesing for Liberty. It's going to be a little more regular from now on. A big thank you to Vince Gordon for agreeing to come on the show and for providing really great discussion and content for today's show. And overall,
thank you so much, Rod.
Just thank you to everyone.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. All right. And with that, it is time to go. So thank you very much. I will see you next week. I'm Rod Jones, and joining me has been
Vince Gordon.
All right, let's go.